You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Robe. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. This week on the Roundup, the aftermath of the BNR in Modern and Pioneer. Then on the flashback, our testing results with Setessan Champion. Finally, on the brew session, we've got new takes on Narset, Parter of Veils. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 46 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joined by my guy on the left coast, Damon Alexander. Damon, what's going on?
Hey, just living this work from home life, going a little crazy. Nice to see some friendly faces.
Yeah, it's nice. We are not gathering together. We are observing some social distance. We want to take a quick note here to plug a special coronavirus-centered podcast you recorded, and it should already be posted. It's definitely something with a lot of valuable information people should check out. Anything you'd like to share about that?
Yeah, we recorded a bonus episode on coronavirus. It's something that we're taking pretty seriously. We've been following the news a lot. I think at the point you're hearing this, everything in the podcast will be hopelessly out of date, but it'll provide a nice little time capsule of what things looked like a few weeks ago.
And there's lots of advice in there that I think is timeless, though. You guys did a good job breaking down how we can minimize risk to ourselves, minimize risk to our older relatives and the infirm, etc.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of someone who is not infirm, we are joined, as always, by the CEO of the podcast, Cave Dan Online. Dan Shriver, what's going on, buddy?
It's funny you say that, Dave, because I've been like on my sickbed for going on 7-8 days now. It's been a struggle out here. I seem to be recovering, but yeah, we'll see.
Just like the flu, or what do you think you have?
Hopefully just the flu, but these things have a way of sticking with you. It's good that you're keeping me at a safe distance, I'll put it that way.
So before we get too deep into, well, we still got to talk about Magic, you know, even in the age of the plague, just like the Decameron, we all have to tell our 10 tales to stay entertained. I mean, life has to go on. Before we get too deep into the latest and greatest in the world of Magic, we want to give a shout out to our new patrons. They are Mark W., Bert W., and Timothy L. Thank you very much for joining us. We're glad you guys are really enjoying the material we're releasing, and welcome. Just a reminder to everyone, if you enjoy what we do and you want to support us, please feel free to join our Patreon. You never have to. Our content will always be free.
Patreon is a great way to support the independent content creators that make the content you love. It's completely optional, but we do have various tiers and little rewards that you can get as a thank you for joining. One of those is access to our Discord, where you can come chat with us at any hour of the day. It's a great place to come hang out and talk brews. Patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is a place where you can find that if you'd like to sign up.
Lots of great ideas getting chopped up in there. Dan's starting to fall in love with lots of the memes that are getting posted, so keep doing that. It brings joy to a man on his sickbed. So the biggest news in the Magic world from this last week was the banned and restricted announcement. So just a quick reminder about the two formats that we're most interested in. Although if you want to speak on Legacy, Damon, we'll certainly give you the floor for a couple minutes. So first of all, on Pioneer, there were no bans. And I think that came as a surprise, at least to myself. I think we all last week were thinking there might be at least one, maybe multiple bannings in Pioneer. And in Modern, Once Upon a Time was banned. I think Dan called that exactly. And I think Damon and I were kind of leaning towards that maybe being the right call as well. So maybe let's start in Modern, because there was an actual ban. You guys were not surprised? You thought it was the right move? Did you want other cards to be banned, or you thought this was sufficient for right now?
I'm a little surprised. I think Once Upon a Time is certainly a good choice of a ban. It just felt like it was a card that kind of helped push the Amulet Titan type decks to the next level in a way that made them a little bit too dominant. And it also affected a lot of other decks, like, you know, like these like black-green Yawgmoth decks or these Eldrazi Tron decks, etc. And to that extent, it was maybe overly prevalent. I don't know if like that was the best way to take down Titan decks from being kind of at their forefront. Now they're powered up by Field of the Dead, Dryad of the Elysian Grove, etc., losing kind of like their best cantrip. We'll see how much of an impact that has on that deck's performance.
One of the interesting things that has developed since the BNR was announced a week ahead of time, and then once we saw that they were going to take action against Once Upon a Time, is that in Magic Online, where the modern metagame moves very fast, Amulet has kind of fallen off the top of the metagame. If we're thinking of this as aimed at the Primeval Titan decks, one could make the case that that actually wasn't necessary. The metagame online had already adjusted just based on the diversity that you see in Magic Online results. And even SCG regionals, these are tournaments that are held in 12 cities. They're each 5K events. Really diverse set of decks made the top 8 in those events, and it wasn't dominated by Primeval Titan by any stretch. In that sense, I don't like the card, and I feel like it was too much of a boon for archetypes like that, but it might not have been necessary just by the numbers.
I mean, E-tron is actually having better results, so maybe it was an E-tron ban.
There was a lot of E-tron lately. That deck just never goes away, like squirrels, as you said.
That was a shocking development in itself, the fact that all of these E-tron decks converged on this green splash as the correct build.
Yeah, it makes sense that it really powers up the decks in particular that need either not just a good creature selection, but also good land selection. E-tron is certainly one of those decks.
It just shows you the power of this card. I think E-tron was playing one forest. They had one green source in the deck, the list I was seeing. So there you go. This is a free cantrip.
Well, your first Once Upon a Time helps you find your forest.
Absolutely, exactly.
It's a perfect circle.
When you splash a color to make your mana more consistent, that's awesome. That's the way Magic was meant to be.
That reminds me of a point made by someone in our Discord. We were discussing, what do we make of this ban? Was this the right call? The point that was made was that Once Upon a Time, from a certain point of view, is a color pie violation because it's sort of like Phyrexian mana in the sense that the average amount of color mana spent on Once Upon a Time will be less than one green. That's not an exact calculation, but you guys know what I'm talking about, right?
Quoting Obi-Wan Kenobi when he's just straight up lying to Luke Skywalker is awesome. What I told you was true from a certain point of view. Like, no, we got it, man. What are you running for Senate here?
Right. The Eldrazi Tron deck is the best example of what that means in practice. By the Frank Carson numbers, you could not or should not splash a card like Ancient Stirrings into Eldrazi Tron off one forest and four exhibition maps. But Eldrazi Tron does it anyway with Once Upon a Time because when the card really matters, using the power of the opening hand, the power of the London Mulligan, you probably don't have to actually pay green for it. So you get this really powerful effect without having to pay the cost of actually putting green lands in your deck.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, obviously different format, but that's one of the issues with Pioneer is people would literally just splash it in a format with much worse mana. Pioneer obviously does not have the Fetch Shock mana base, and they'd play no green spells at all. I think Caleb had a bunch of great decks that were basically mono white that played like 8 green dual lands and no green spells because Once Upon a Time was by far the best cantrip. But yeah, this is just the modern version of that. So great top-down design, but you know, just terrible design.
I saw a funny post on Instagram. I wish I remember who to give credit to. What to do with your Once Upon a Times, and they showed it being used as like a House of Cards or like Kindling or a little like table wedge to shim a table if it's uneven.
Are they legal in Legacy at least?
Yeah, but somehow it's not seeing a whole lot of play there. One of my friends asked me, like, what do I do with my 8 Once Upon a Times? And I was like, I guess you're going to have to build 8 Commander or Canlander decks. Can't think of a whole lot else to do with them.
So the second card from Eldraine gets banned out of the 3 paper-supported formats of WotC within 4 months of its release.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
2019 Magic.
I was thinking about this, like, if Once Upon a Time and Oko were the 2 best cards in Eldraine, but there's still Mystical Dispute, there's still Mystic Sanctuary. Are these cards on track for getting banned? I mean, they are really, really more powerful than anything else in their respective formats at what they do. We might not even be done with this yet.
Well, I can tell you Mystic Sanctuary is not going to get banned in Pioneer anytime soon. Card is exceedingly safe. In any format without fetch lands, that card's very fine. So that's I can live with a design like that from Wizards if they're not going to worry about fetch lands.
Yeah, I mean, Mystical Dispute is obviously a very strong card, but it kind of is more or less doing what it's supposed to do. It's a blue anti-blue card. And so when the blue decks get good, they fight against each other and they jam all these Mystical Disputes in, which makes the other color decks able to prey on them more effectively.
Yeah, I mean, the key with Mystical Dispute is just not giving blue the best threats. So, you know, when Oko or Uro or whatever are the best threats, then it encourages a strange series of deck building choices that gets a little uncomfortable. But as long as, you know, red and black and, I mean, white, ha ha ha, can do other things that are proactive, then like Damon's saying, they can punish people for playing a 3 mana leak. That's not that powerful of a card.
Right. I think one of the reasons why these inverter decks apparently have like lower win rates now is that they're forced to spend a lot of their slots fighting against other inverter decks for the mirror match. And so one of those cards that they'll play usually as a 4 of in their 75 is Mystical Dispute.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of lists playing 2 main and 2 sideboard. So speaking of the inverter deck, we can move to Pioneer. No bans at all. Last week, we cautioned against predicting what Wizards would do, but discussed maybe what they ought to do. I don't think any of us called for no bans. What was your impression of the no ban, Damon?
We just don't have the data that WotC does. I mean, I did not expect Inverter to only have a 49% win rate. I have trouble reconciling that number with what I see happen in tournaments, when I see people stream it, how well they do, with just how good the deck seems to me. But that's what the numbers say.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, David, what was your reaction to the announcement? Because one thing that you've hit on repeatedly throughout the lifetime of Pioneer is that there haven't been statements of first principles, as you call them, about what WotC has in mind for the format. And in this announcement, if you just sort of read very carefully the sentences that they put out there, they kind of give some hint as to what they're looking for when they're trying to evaluate, is a combo deck too strong, or is the play pattern unhealthy, or are people just complaining too much? So did you feel like from this announcement that you got any clarity from the sense of what WotC thinks Pioneer should be?
No, not at all. I also don't believe their 49% win rate. A data point like that without context means nothing to me. I agree with Damon. When you actually see the results, when people want to win tournaments, they play this deck overwhelmingly, and they do very well. We have not seen it get pushed out of the 5-0 deck dumps, the online PTQs, any other tournament that matters. When you watch high-level pros stream with it, they win constantly. They don't have 2-3 leagues. My personal experience playing against the deck is I have a terrible record against it, so if they're at 49%, the rest of you guys out there must be doing an awesome job. There's multiple articles by a bunch of sophisticated pros on multiple sites describing how there is no bad matchup for the deck, and they've tried this and that and this, and they don't have good matchups against it. And then the totally subjective experience of playing against it is lots of games against it are interesting because it is a strange win condition. There's another 50 or 60% of the games that aren't interesting at all. They just thoughtsies, play their inverter on four. If you're not playing black or blue, they just can comfortably do that, and then they just win the next turn. I don't enjoy those kind of games, but there are people who say that they do. And, you know, like I said, if they don't want to ban anything, I think they should consider unbanning some of the quote-unquote fair cards that are banned right now.
Get back Vela Summer in there. Take that, thoughtsies.
Let me read a few choice sentences from this announcement and get your take on this. This is in reference to community concerns about some of the new combos that came out with the release of Theros. The announcement reads, "In general, we're okay with combo having a presence in the Pioneer metagame, but it is certainly possible to have combos that are too strong or too prevalent. Combo decks can be unhealthy in large doses, especially when they are difficult to interact with, win quickly, or win too often." From there, they mention that Dimir Inverter is only winning at 49%, that it has unfavorable matchups against 5 of the other top 10 most played decks, the win rate has been going down. They then mention Lotus Breach, which is at an even lower win rate, they say, and specifically cite the card Damping Sphere as a sideboard answer. The next paragraph mentions the Heliod Ballista combo. Now here they just say, "Decks using the Heliod Ballista combo have yet to prove themselves consistently in competitive tournaments and aren't showing up at play rates we consider problematic. In addition, many decks that include the combo do so alongside another primary game plan, which means more diversity of gameplay and fewer games ending with the combo finish."
Yeah, those are a series of sentences in the English language written by a corporation. All right. I mean.
Yeah.
First of all, putting Heliod in the same sentence as Inverter and Breach is like already a sign that we're talking about people who have no idea how Pioneer works.
Well, the Heliod mono white decks are actually putting up pretty good results these days.
Yeah, I think the Heliod deck is quite good, much better than I thought it was, as we've discussed in previous weeks. But playing against it is nothing like playing against these other decks. When I'm playing against Heliod, you don't have a bunch of sideboard cards specifically for that. You don't have to mulligan down to sideboard cards that are specifically good against them.
I disagree. Have you ever heard of the card Glare of Heresy?
I have.
I had not, and now I see it in deckless sideboards. And it is against Heliod.
A lot of the Heliod lists play it, in fact.
Yeah. I was happily playing this match. Felt like I was pretty ahead against them. They had like a Heliod, and they were going to have four mana, and I was like, well, I had a Glare of Heresy in hand, was about to exile their Heliod, but I was like, I can take a turn off and do something else. And then they go, Walking Ballista on two, Idyllic Grange, pump it up, give it lifelink, game over. You know, I don't know. It's pretty strong.
Should have played that Gideon's Intervention.
I know. I don't think the deck is overpowered. I think it's a strong deck and does occasionally do things that are kind of frustrating. I think losing to Kiki Jiki combo is just not a fun way to lose a match of Magic. It's even worse than like Show and Tell Emrakul.
What they say about Heliod Ballista, to me that actually says that the win rate is pretty high for this deck. They treat it separately from Inverter and Lotus Breach. Those, they're saying, they're not winning that much. Heliod, they're saying, well, it just hasn't proven itself consistently
in competitive tournaments.
Right, and it's not showing up at rates we consider problematic, and the play patterns are varied. Then they conclude by saying they're going to monitor criteria including matchup by matchup win rates, success in tournaments, population in the metagame, and community sentiment playing with and against these decks. They hope to not make any changes until late April after the Players Tour Finals in Houston.
Yeah. I mean, one thing with the win rates on MTGO that is just kind of hard to think about is that a lot of people play Dimir Inverter at this point, and it could be that it's more like the top grinders or some elite class of grinders are the ones playing Heliod Ballista at a much higher level of skill than the average Inverter player. And when the top Inverter players play it, they get much better than 49% results. That's one possible way to interpret these numbers.
Anecdotally, I would say I've started to play against much worse Inverter players who have lost games. I feel like if I had Damon playing on the other side, he would never lose. And they're just like giving me all these chances to possibly win. Now, you still lose some of those games because of the way the deck plays out, but
Inverter is a hard deck to play.
Yeah, very complicated, operates on totally different axes. I understand to some extent why people claim that they like the Inverter mirror, etc., because there are lots of variables in play that aren't normally in play in Magic, but...
So I guess the takeaway that I'm hearing is that, David, nothing that they can say or do will restore your confidence in their management of the format at this point. You're not impressed by the announcement itself.
I'm not impressed by the paragraph you read. I still don't understand why certain cards were banned. Like, why is Looter Scooter banned? Is it just because Mono Black had a high win rate then? Is the argument that if they unbanned it now, Mono Black would be the best deck? I mean, is that something that someone's claiming?
Yeah, I mean, the bans are all decided at a certain point in time, in a certain context, and we are definitely no longer in that same context anymore. And so as a result, yeah, I mean, maybe Copter is fine. It certainly is not overpowered in, you know, Inverter. They're not going to play that card, even consider playing that card. And it might be an effective card against a deck like that. But they're not going to ban Copter. Don't get your hopes up, Dave. I'm sorry.
No, I don't think they're going to unban anything. They've been very loath to do that in Modern. And every unban has been shown that the card that they banned was, you know, kind of not the boogeyman it was meant to be.
One thing that I find slightly strange about Pioneer right now is all these Nykthos decks. They have such high variance with like how good their best draws are and their worst draws are that it's just kind of frustrating. Like, you never really know if your mono green Karn opponent is going to just completely just annihilate you by turn three or whatever, or just like futz around and like play a Nissa on turn four and that like with no follow up.
Yeah, it is kind of crazy. So they basically said the nut draws from mono green are okay, but if we eliminate Once Upon a Time and Oath of Nissa, then they just won't do it a lot. So it's sort of like the Neoform deck of Pioneer. Sometimes on turn three, the game's functionally over, and then other times it doesn't do anything at all, and you can beat it with any deck at all. It operates in a different way, but it literally has two key cards that do everything, and the rest of the deck does nothing.
I think that's just part of Magic. I don't know how you would get rid of that. Anyone can build a deck that can nut draw.
I mean, there's one specific land that creates this gameplay thing. I've got a very, very simple recommendation for how to get rid of it, if you're worried about it.
Print Wasteland. I agree, Dave.
Goddamn Legacy players. So speaking of Legacy, I think we've nattered on about Pioneers long enough. What was your impression of the Legacy ban, Damon? What I saw from people who play Legacy is that they were surprised how quick they were to ban a card in a format that's kind of famous for being able to adjust. I mean, this card's only been in Legacy for a few weeks. Have you played a lot of Legacy? Have you played specifically against this card? Do you have an opinion about the banning? We're specifically talking about Underworld Breach was banned out of Legacy.
2020 Magic.
There's been a card banned out of everything since Ravnica, so we're on a three yep. or four set winning streak.
Yep. I am a little sad to see it go. I think that the data shows that the deck was like just completely overpowered, and I believe that. That said, I managed to tune my Maverick deck to the point where like it was a super fun, interesting matchup where I felt like I had a pretty good edge, but it was kind of like a knife fight with a tiger where you are definitely favored, but one wrong move and you're getting your arm like sliced off.
Whoa.
Maybe you're favored with a knife against a tiger.
Like, as a skilled magician or a skilled knife fighter against, not an average, certainly me against a tiger with a knife, I think I would lose.
I see.
But I think like a skilled knives person is favored against a tiger.
I'm betting heavily on the tiger myself.
Vegas has taken that one off the board. I don't know if you can really even...
Yeah, it's certainly a highly unethical scenario to host for fun.
They would call it animal abuse, but the tiger had no visible wounds after its battle.
Okay, so maybe as Maverick, I'm on the favorite side of this fight. Maybe that is the tiger side. One wrong move and the human slices off your, you know, whatever. But it was super interesting because main deck, I had the possibility of Green Sun Zenith into Collector Oof main deck. That is not a card I would normally play main deck alongside my Umzao with Jit, not a good combo, but it's just so effective against that deck. If you assemble that plus Sylvan Safekeeper in main or side games, you actually just kind of lock them out besides their Monastery Mentor lines. which actually are quite strong. So you do have to be very respectful of Monastery Mentor. But then I would bring in these Dryad Militants, Deafening Silences. I'd play Thalia's, bring in a couple, some pieces of Graveyard Hay, bring in a Soul Guide Lantern. Some of these games, I'd look at my board by turn four and have like a Gaddock Teak, a Sylvan Safekeeper, a Thalia, and a Deafening Silence, and be like, they just cannot win this game. There were times where they would just play literally Swords to Plowshares, Force of Will, Teferi, and Monastery Mentor, and my deck would just completely crumble against it sometimes. It was super fun to play that matchup. After a little bit of practice, I felt pretty good about it. So I kind of enjoyed being matched up against it as a result. But I think that was kind of an exception. I had to really push my sideboard around a lot to make it favorable. I think a lot of other decks like didn't necessarily have access to such good tools against it.
Or they weren't crazy like you and didn't put those cards main deck. That hypothetical board state you just described where you have five very specific narrow hate cards all in play. Yeah, that's magic.
Some of those cards are out of the sideboard, but Gaddock Teak is sufficiently flexible main deck that it is kind of worth it. It shuts off Terminus, it shuts off a whole host of random cards in Legacy. Force of Will, Sneak Attack.
It shuts off Green Sun Zenith, but it's worth it.
It does. You have to kind of sequence it carefully. Thalia is kind of one of the cornerstones of the deck that gives it the ability to fight against combo. Collector Roof is actually, you know, there's a lot of decks where it's actually pretty good, even if it is a slight non-bow with Jit.
So do you feel like they were doing Legacy players a favor by taking this early action, or do you feel like it was disrespectful to players like yourself who are willing to work hard to master the Tiger?
From seeing other people playing other decks, I think it was... I mean, the deck was crushing the MTGO challenges, for example, which are some of the kind of highest level organized Legacy play we have these days. I'm pretty confident it was like the right decision.
Well, that's good to know.
So it turns out cheaper Yawgmoth's Will is good in Legacy. It was hard to predict that, but, you know, here we are.
Well, it's not just cheaper. It lets you recast your LED multiple times. That's like the most messed up part. Just LED, 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 brain. You just keep casting. Yeah. They need to get exiled after they get cast again, and they don't. And now they won't because it's banned.
They have no need for your rational input on their card file. Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, well, I mean, that just isn't how Escape works. Escape is meant for permanence more than spells.
Now, normally the last thing we have to discuss for any banned and restricted announcement is where does the format go from here? But in this case, in Modern, I kind of already intimated that the format had already moved on from Once Upon a Time being at the top of the metagame, and it's quite diverse, and I expect that to continue to be the case. So basically, Modern continues to be wide open. I would not expect any drastic shifts in the metagame because of this ban specifically. Likewise, in Pioneer, there were no changes, so the format's just going to keep trucking along as it was.
McWinsauce and a few others crushed the MTGO PTQ on this revamped Bant Snow Control, where they just kind of swap out, you know, they looked at their deck pre-Oko ban and were like, oh man, we lose this nice one blue-green card. Whatever will we put here? Maybe it's time to go straight back to blue-white. And then Uro was printed and they just popped those in.
That deck did have a good tournament, I think 3 or 4 copies in the top 16 of this Bant Control, but that's on like any given Sunday. On the Saturday challenge before that, it was different decks winning, and then at SCG Regionals, it was different decks winning. 2 weeks ago, we were all worried about Underworld Breach in Modern. That deck seems to have not panned out, so I think Modern is going to be shifting around a lot, and I'm not too concerned by a good day for any one archetype at this point. I think it's a great time to be diving back into Modern, personally.
Yeah, honestly, I think Modern is in a really good spot right now. I think Modern is one of the better formats out there. It has like the right level of card pool and fundamental Modern balance versus Legacy with like the dual lands and Wasteland and all that.
Yeah, and it's much better than Pioneer. I'm just saying Modern's better than Pioneer. I'm happy to make that statement.
I'm not saying I disagree with you. I'm not saying you aren't happy to make that statement.
But we like Modern. That's the thing. It means something different when you say it, Dave.
I like Modern. Pioneer was briefly better. Then that dream died. So anyway, that's the kind of state of play and the formats we're interested in anyway. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to talk about our card from last week, Setessan Champion. All right, we are back. So our card from last week was Setessan Champion. This is a new Enchantress effect. When we say Enchantress effect, it's a card that draws a card every time an enchantment is cast or comes into play. From the new set, Theros, Setessan Champion is 2 and a green for a 1/3 with the Constellation ability. Whenever an enchantment enters the battlefield under your control, put a +1/+1 counter on Sedestan Champion and draw a card. So we had a few lists that we were interested to try in Pioneer. Damon, you played the green-white Enchantress list through a league. Do you want to talk about your impressions of the deck?
Yeah, this deck features 4 Sedestan Champion and 4 Eidolon of Blossoms as your Enchantress effects. And then from there, I put in 4 Llanowar Elves over Dave's initial sketch just to kind of get the ball rolling earlier. The numbers also were kind of all over the place besides the 4 of Wolfellow Haven also on the ramp side. I had 3 Course of Krufix, 2 Herald of the Pantheon, I had a random Heliod Suncrowned, just why not? Calyx Destiny's Hand, why not? I had 1 Mana Bloom, which is a card you can rebuy to kind of get more enchantment triggers. And then a couple Baffling End, a couple Seal Away, some Banishing Lights, Sphere of Safeties, and Sigil of the Empty Thrones as these kind of prison or closer cards. And then a 22 land mana base. And I went 2-3. The deck kind of felt... I still don't have a good grasp on it. I wish I had time to take it through another league. Llanowar Elves felt like by far the best card in the deck. It unfortunately doesn't trigger your Enchantress effects. But having that fast start would be such a big deal. Especially if you're on the draw against a Llanowar Elf start, like, and you don't have your own Llanowar Elves, you feel so far behind. Wolfellow Haven is just a little bit too slow on the draw in those situations. What felt really powerful is around turn 4, turn 5, the deck would really kind of turn a corner. It wouldn't, like, you know, take a 90-degree turn around a corner. It would kind of curve around the corner. You have one turn where you kind of get the ball rolling. The next turn, you start getting some value, play your second Enchantress, and then the next turn is where you kind of pop off. And then hope that how you're popping off that you manage to win. One thing I noticed with Alarm in a few games was that these Enchantress effects are not may draw, they are must draw. And so you're like, aha, I have 4 Enchantress effects in play. I'm going to get so much value. And then you start realizing, like, I have 30 cards in my library. I can cast 8 more enchantments this game. This is weird. You can draw your whole deck, but you can't play your whole deck. So something to think about.
On that note, what were the cards that you were expecting to kill the opponent with? Was Sedestan Champion going to be your finisher? Because it does grow every time an enchantment comes into play.
Sedestan Champion was fine, but here's the thing, is that, like, this happens around turn, you know, 6 or 7, maybe, where you really are getting it big. Even if you cast a turn 3, you look at a turn 4 or 5, and you're like, I have a 4-6 in play, haha. But it's a 4-6, right? Like, it's not going to kill the opponent very fast on its own. If they have any sort of chump blocker, much less a Lovestruck Beast, it still doesn't get through. And then when it does finally get bigger, they've gotten even more time to start assembling blockers. And so really, like, the kill condition for the deck felt like some combination of just watching the light drain from their eyes when you have a Sphere of Safety and 8 enchantments and they have 4 lands. Sigil of the Empty Throne turns the corner pretty fast. You just get all these 4-4 flyers. Starfield of Nyx, weirdly enough, first off makes your Eidolon of Blossoms a 4-4, which I didn't really appreciate until it happened. And furthermore, just gives you this... You attack with your Baffling End. What are they going to do? Block it? Like, nothing really good happens for them in that case.
Can you go back to that Starfield of Nyx interaction you were mentioning with Eidolon of Blossoms?
Yeah, so Starfield of Nyx makes your non-aura enchantments a creature, in addition to its other types, with base power toughness equal to its converted mana cost. And guess what Eidolon of Blossoms is? It is a non-aura enchantment, and it becomes base power and toughness 4. So it's now a 4-4.
That's really interesting. That never occurred to me.
I know. I was brawling against a Nyssa with a bunch of 3-3 lands in play, and I was like, oh, my Eidolons are kind of big now. Corsair of Krufix becomes a 3-3. And yeah, you have these Baffling Ends of Seal Away sitting in the creature line, ready to go into combat. It was nice because if you kind of go off, you have just access to enough Banishing Lights that, you know, one game my opponent had, like, a Vivian, they had an 8-8 Burning Tree Emissary and, like, an 8-8 Verdurous Gearhulk, and I was like, Banishing Light, your BTE, Banishing Light, your Gearhulk, Banishing Light, your Vivian, attack with my beefy Eidolons. I think some of the deck building choices I made were quite excellent. By having this Calyx and Heliod, it made sideboarding super easy. I just cut those immediately without really thinking about it. I never cast Calyx once. You already waste so much time casting Eidolon of Blossoms, which doesn't affect the board at all. Calyx just did not seem like I would have the ability to defend it at the point I would be casting it. And then, like, his downtick doesn't even hit Planeswalkers.
I'd like to spend a minute with this card. Calyx Destiny's Hand is a mythic from the most recent expansion, so that's a Planeswalker. That should be an exciting card, but almost no one talks about this card. I'm not even sure what it does.
They went back to designing, like, Planeswalkers the way they should, where they're 4 mana, conditional draw for one very specific type of deck, and -3 super conditional removal.
Yeah, it feels like a Planeswalker from 3 years ago.
It starts with 4 loyalty. It reads, +1, look at your top 4, you may reveal an enchantment card. The rest go on the bottom. -3, turn one of your enchantments that's already on the battlefield into a Banishing Light?
No, not a Banishing Light. Banishing Light hits any permanent.
Oh, gosh. Exile target creature or enchantment you don't control. until target enchantment you control leaves the battlefield. Okay, so you can get some stuff. Not planeswalkers, not artifacts. Yeah, that guy's going to the bench. Okay.
Yep. The Heliod actually felt better than I thought. There might be a way to build a deck with more Heliod-centric, much like astronomers in the 18th century. Because with Herald of the Pantheon and Course of Crucifix, you have some incidental life gain triggers. And sometimes when the deck is turning the corner, you're like, well, I actually can't really get lethal in this turn. There were times where I could be like, I can get an attack in for 17. They're at 20 because this deck has no early game aggro. A few counters would actually maybe go a long way. Herald of the Pantheon, actually, I thought it was not very good, and so I cut down to 2. It was actually pretty good because, for example, it makes your Wolfwillow Havens effectively be free, and it lets you, at the turn you're comboing, like really, really extend how much you can do in one turn. You know, instead of casting 2 to 3 enchantments, you can cast, you know, 4 to 6. To get into results, I went 2 and 3. I played against Blue-White Spirits. I easily beat them game 1 when they mulled to 5, and then I just kind of got crushed by Rattle Chains and Spell Quellers in the remaining games. I beat Green Devotion. My opponent got kind of mad at his deck in chat after the game, and we spent a few minutes talking about the state of Pioneer. There were some really interesting matches, though. I had a really strong start. I had multiple Enchantress effects. I had Baffling Ended and Seal Away a couple of his cards. Meanwhile, he had a Vivian at 6 and a Nykthos and like a Jade Light Ranger. And it was like, what can they get with that? They're not quite Ulamog mana, but they will be soon. So it was not clear which deck's Haymakers would kind of come out on top. But I guess they went for like a Gear Hulk, and the Gear Hulk just like didn't stop the kind of combo I had the next turn. Then I got crushed by Gruul aggro. That was brutal. It just wasn't close. I was on the draw game 1. And then game 2, I tried my best. I had a Sphere of Safety. They had a Shadow Torch of Defiance, and I died. Couldn't find the Banishing Light. Calyx doesn't do anything against Chandra. Doesn't do anything against Chandra. Then playing against Green Stompy. And I actually felt like I should have had a decent matchup there, but game 2, I like mulled and I bottomed a Sigil of the Empty Throne as my kind of only gas piece card. And so my hand had like a Course of Crucifix and some like a Wolfwillow Haven and like a removal spell. And I just like in my top 15 cards never drew a single Enchantress effect. And it turns out that you can't really just keep casting Baffling Ends as your one spell a turn. You will get overrun at some point by like whether it be Great Henge or whatever. And then I played White Devotion and I beat them 2-1. So 2-3. The deck actually, sometimes it felt a little anemic. Sometimes it felt pretty good. Something that is maybe worth spending more time on at some point.
It's interesting that you're describing it as a combo finish. Do you feel like this deck actually needs this card draw engine, the 8 Enchantress effects?
Well, if you don't have that.
Well, I mean, you said you killed them with Sigil of the Empty Throne.
Yeah, those only really work if you have a lot of enchantments in hand. And you have to like deploy enchantments early because they're part of your deck, right? You can't just like hold on to your Baffling End until turn 6. You need to be able to generate critical massive enchantments in the mid game, and that only happens if you have a lot of card draw. All the cards in this deck are like pretty bad on their own. They kind of only work in large numbers.
So you felt like 8 was the right number. 4 Eidolons, 4 Champions.
I would play more if I could. I guess there is that one from M20, the one green-white one. That actually, honestly, maybe we should be playing some of those. I actually would be happy playing 10 Enchantresses. The deck kind of can't win without them. Think of it that way.
What is the text on the green-white one?
It's just an Enchantress. Whenever enchantment ETBs, you draw a card, right?
This is Satyr Enchanter, an uncommon from Corset 2019, I want to say.
Oh, this is a cast trigger.
Whenever you cast an enchantment spell, draw a card.
Yeah, and it's a 3-drop, right? Eidolon of Blossoms is the, I would say, better Enchantress between that and Setessan Champion. But being a 3-drop is actually still quite good. The deck just actually can't win without an Enchantress.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, you need all these cards. The problem is, like Damon is saying, is you need them all together to be strong enough, but they're individually so weak, it like caps how good your deck can be.
Yeah. You can't play a Sigil of the Empty Throne on turn 4 or turn 5, and next turn make one enchantment, and be like super proud of your 1/4/4 angel. You could have just cast a Baneslayer Angel, much less a Sarah Angel at that point.
What if I replaced the Setessan Champions with Crucifix's Insight? That's 2 and a green, look at your top 6, take up to 3 enchantments.
That is an interesting one. I'm not sold on it. The nice thing is that these Enchantress effects let you, at the point that you establish multiple Enchantresses, it lets you accept the fact that your deck doesn't actually have 45 enchantments in it. It only has around 30. And this lets you play cards like Llanowar Elves, which I think is actually super important for this deck to be not just super clunky. Crucifix's Insight really kind of punishes you for playing these cards like Llanowar Elves. There's nothing sadder than getting to turn 5 without an Enchantress effect in this kind of deck.
So final verdict on the build. What's promising, or where do you think the build should go from here?
I think the Enchantresses plus Llanowar Elves plus a bunch of enchantments. Like, I think there's like maybe something here. I think there's just tuning the overall game plan, the curve, how many mana dorks, what the right kind of inevitability conditions are. There's just a lot of room. What to put in the slot after you cut Kalix. Anything's better than Kalix.
So that's one take on a green-white Enchantress for Pioneer. David, you also took a spin with this Enchantress core in a slightly different shell. Did you have any better results?
No, I had identical results, actually. I went 2-3. My deck was built around Enigmatic Incarnation, which is a card that can both fetch up our Setessan Champion. It also can create end-of-turn triggers for no mana the turn you play a Setessan Champion, was the thought process. It had four Willful Haven, which was a similar card with Damon's deck. I had six Enchantress effects. I had two Eidolon of Blossoms and three Setessan Champions. The only other cards that were the same as Damon's deck were the three Corsair of Krufix. And then the rest of it was kind of filled with various enchantments and creatures at various points on the mana curve that Enigmatic Incarnation can tutor out. So there was like one Nightmare Shepherd, one Doomwake Giant, one Dragon Lord Silumgar at the six slot. I tried the six mana Sultai creature that lets you play a permanent of each type and found it was just way, way too slow.
This is Muldrotho the Gravetide you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Because I do have fetch lands in the deck, and then of course you have enchantments and creatures, so the thought is like once you play that, you can get, you know, like basically three cards a turn. But that was just really slow. I never wanted a tutor for it. So yeah, the deck played pretty clunky, as a lot of these Enigmatic Incarnation lists feel. I did play against a kind of a who's who of good decks in the format. I played the mono-green Devotion Karn list. I played Inverter twice. Bant Spirits. And then I timed out versus this very strange Bant Flash list that also played four Uro. I not only got timed out in that match, I started another league and got halfway through it before I started this podcast and timed out against that person again. So they're not good at winning games of Magic, but they are really good at not losing. And there's just so many triggers and tutoring choices and stuff I have to make. They're also playing tons of Planeswalkers. They must have seven versions of Teferi in their list. So I was just grinding through that and Wraths. And then they cast Uro, and I'd exile Uro. And it was just...
Watsi really named Enigmatic Incarnation pretty well. Every time that trigger goes on the stack, it just takes a little while to figure out what the hell you're doing with it.
In one of the games, I literally was like, oh, I can finally sack this thing and tutor. And I looked at my deck, and there was literally no creatures left. They had all been Wrathed or exiled with various like Seeloy-like effects. So I was just like, all right, I mean, that's a wrap. I don't know what to say. I had nothing to tutor for.
Yeah, some cards get really interesting terminal conditions. I played a match on Maverick against Blue-White Helm. And so their goal is to assemble Rest in Peace plus Energy Field so they basically can't take damage. And Energy Field only says you can't take damage if you lose a permanent to your graveyard, it dies. But they have Rest in Peace so that never happens. And they play Helm of Obedience, which fundamentally doesn't do anything except if you have a Rest in Peace out, it mills the opponent. And so at some point in game one, I realized I can assemble this like weird Gaddock Teague, Sylvan Safekeeper lock on them so they can't kill my Gaddock Teague, which means I can never play their Helm of Obedience. And that's normally a win condition. And I look at the cards and they have 39 cards and I have 40. And I was like, I can win this game, even though I had, like, I have no way to kill any of their enchantments at this point. And so one thing I learned, for example, is asymptotically, your final hand as you deck out will always be four greens on Zenith.
So tell me about the dream starts. As you were putting this list together with the Enigmatic Incarnation, what were some of the best lines you could open on? I assume they involve like a Willful Haven in some capacity.
Yeah, so one of the thought was, if you made me like put a gun to my head and maybe play the best version of this deck, I would not play three Setessan Champion. But, you know, in the spirit of the podcast, I would, yeah, begin to put good cards in the deck. But I played three Setessan Champion, even though I could also tutor for them in the spirit of the podcast. So yeah, if you play Enigmatic Incarnation on three off your Willful Haven, then you can tutor up turn three Setessan Champion with the ability to play multiple enchantments on your next turn and then sack them to get another enchantment creature. So you get to draw two or three cards. The thing that's kind of interesting is you have the ability to play enchantments at instant speed, which came up a couple times. The Omen of the Sea triggering the champion to make it bigger at instant speed or to trigger your Doomwake Giant to make their creatures smaller, like on EOT. Like you find the Doomwake Giant at the end of your turn with your enchantment, you give a -1/-1 counter, and then you cast the enchantment to sweep their board against like mono green was pretty cool. Or you can like stack your triggers. If you have two Enigmatic Incarnations in play, you can stack them both. So I would sometimes get Yarok, then the 4/6, and you give all their creatures -2/-2, and then the enchantment also triggers your Setessan Champion twice or your Eidolon of Blossoms twice.
Yeah, Yarok was just good stuff in this deck.
Basically, the deck just plays out super sweet, but playing super sweet decks is not what Pioneer's about anymore. And so my opponent would just be like, that's cool, man. Thoughtseize. Dig through time on turn 3. Inverter, you can't. Literally, I drew like 3 cards. I was like, all right, if he uses a Thoughtseize, I win. Like, nah, that's okay. And like, all right, next turn I win. Like, yep, GG's. And then we just did it again, turn 2. And it feels terrible having to mulligan against Thoughtseize decks, of course, because it's like, am I going to mulligan a better card that they just Thoughtseize? And of course I did, so. And then I beat Inverter, which was awesome.
Were you playing Brain Maggots at all?
I played one Brain Maggot in the side. It was terrible. It's a card you can't tutor for easily because you only have one mana enchantment. And they keep all their removal in after board, so it just dies when it comes into play. So you're basically like forced to play it and take a Fatal Push and then just wait for it to die so they get that Fatal Push back.
Well, you can make the case that their removal dies to the Brain Maggot. That's one fewer removal spell that they have. It's not like you got 2-for-1.
Yeah, but if you're going to Thoughtseize, is the card you want to Thoughtseize their Fatal Push?
Yeah, exactly. That's the statement.
I'm not saying play it instead of Thoughtseize. You can still have your Thoughtseizes, but you could play up to 8, right? 4 Thoughtseize, 4 Brain Maggot. The idea being that we're giving Setessan Champion its fair chance, right? You might occasionally get paid off just by having a champion and drawing a Brain Maggot.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is the Setessan Champion does not grow very fast, as Damon was alluding to. Like, it's turn 5 or 6, and you're attacking with, like, a 4-power creature. And eventually, they just, like, draw a Fatal Push or whatever, and they draw, like, the frickin' Bant guy. He would eventually just draw the 3-mana Teferi and bounce it. You just don't have clean answers to all these. You're forced to play all these clunky cards, like make your Setessan Champion more than a 1/3 with no text. And those cards are not all, like, they all conspire to make you very weak against certain classes of permanents. In my particular deck, I was very weak to Planeswalkers, which is why the 6th drop of choice was Dragonlord Silumgar, which took Jace to win a game one time, which felt so awesome. Take Jace, mill you for 2, draw a card, pass the turn. But then again, if they had a freaking instant speed way to kill my dragon, they would have just gotten Jace back in their upkeep and won still. Despite all that, despite how sweet of all the plays I was making, they had like outs to win.
I noticed you have a Singleton Nightmare Shepherd, which is a card that I've been trying to sneak into lists for a while. Did you get anything out of that when you were playing?
I think I only got an actual trigger once when I had to like combo block with my entire board and not die. It is randomly nice against like spirits or something, just to, like tutor up a creature that flies, which the deck is really weak to, and a creature with 4 power to attack planeswalkers. So it was really like a glorified air elemental that triggered my enchantresses. The dream where you get to like sack multiple creatures with it in play to Enigmatic Incarnation never happened. It'd be sweet if it did, though.
You didn't get Plaguecrafter with Nightmare Shepherd at the same time?
No. All these sweet things that could happen don't happen. Like Damon says, you're just way behind. So you're spending turn like 4, 5, and 6 trying to not die. And then you like eventually just draw like 17 cards on turn 8. But you have to not die before you get there. And so you're spending all of your resources. You have to change your sequencing and everything just to not die each turn.
Yeah, when you need Plaguecrafter, usually you need it like now. Not like, oh yeah, let me dirtle and get a Nightmare Shepherd out first.
Yeah, and I'd have to do all kinds of crazy things like sacrifice the Nightmare Shepherd to get a Doomwake Giant to kill all their 1/1s so that the other tutor that I'm doing to get the Plaguecrafter kills their Planeswalker because they'd be, you know, they had Llanowar Elves or whatever in play. I mean, I'm sure eventually it'll happen when I finish my league and I will screenshot it, but...
Wait, what happens if you have a Brought back then? You sack the Nightmare Shepherd to get Doomwake Giant.
The other thing that's cool is with 2 Enigmatic Incarnations in play, because it doesn't target, you can sacrifice one of the Enigmatic Incarnations to get a 5, and you can sack that 5 to get a 6. You can climb up the chain twice in one turn.
Do you have 6s in here?
Yeah, Dragonlord Silumgar.
Oh, it's a 6. I always think that card's a 5.
Whoa. That'd be sweet.
He's an 8 in my book.
So yeah, the deck is sweet. It's super fun to play. There's a bunch of sweet lines, but you know, none of them ultimately matter. You're just going to get Thoughtseized, so. You got to just deal with it. It's all right.
Get this man a Veil of Summer.
So I would say my review is that Setessan Champion is often the 3 that I would tutor up. So I was actually surprised by how reasonable it was. If they don't have Fatal Push, it's actually good against red. They don't play that many 2-mana do 3 damage effects. So you're likely to get a turn or 2 out of it. But against like the white decks, they're playing, you know, 2-mana exile removal. So it was a reasonable card. I think if I had to like build this deck for real, I would play maybe 1 or 2 of them, not 3. It was a fine card. It's one of the few cards that has like power that eventually grows. The way I would eventually win games is I'd normally like neutralize them to some extent and then just get in for like 12 with this Tessin champion.
So let's say that you've figured out that the ideal build of the deck involves X Enchantress effects, 6, 7, whatever. How would you want to distribute those between the Island of Blossoms and the Setessan Champion?
Well, for this deck, Enigmatic Incarnation is kind of another Enchantress effect that has different applications as far as like an engine. So I would probably only want 4 or maybe even 3 effects in this list. And because of the way the casting costs work, I would want 2 of each. Because again, when we talked about this during Enigmatic Incarnation Week, we're trapped in many ways. A lot of times you're going to sack a 2-mana enchantment the turn you play Enigmatic Incarnation, and the 3-mana enchantment creatures are not very powerful, so Courser or Dryad, if they don't have anything worth killing with your 3-2, you want something that's quote-unquote proactive. That's what Setessan Champion would be. It's a threat that they have to deal with that can accrue a bunch of value. And then Eidolon being an enchantment itself is important because you can get it on end of turn, it draws a card, and then the next turn you're again threatening to do a bunch of things, and it can itself ramp up to your 5s, which are a little bit more affecting the board. As Damon said, it's a problem when you're paying 4 mana for a 2-2 that doesn't block effectively. The list I have is pretty close to quote-unquote the ideal list. I just think the constituent parts are just weak. So that was our experiments in Pioneer, Daniel. You bravely took Setessan Champion into the queues of Modern.
I did. And I'm sorry to say that she was not a Setessan Champion. She was more of a Setessan Participation Award. My thought process behind this build was the following. In Modern, there are some enchantments that I actually believe in and will go to bat for arguing with my podcast host or anyone who cares to argue with me about them. I'm talking about the cards Utopia Sprawl, Blood Moon, On Thin Ice, 1-mana snow enchantment aura, enchant a snowland, exile something. It's like a better Path to Exile if you squint. Rest in Peace, Stony Silence in some metagames. We're not there right now. Cards like Suppression Field, I thought, have been well positioned at times. So I was just kind of going through the Modern card pool and trying to figure out what are the enchantments that are not embarrassing to play. And let's just say that I'm going to put a bunch of those in my deck, put some Enchantress effects in there. So Setessan Champion is a 4 of, Eidolon of Blossoms is a 4 of, and then just try to fill it out and see what I'm left with. And by the time I was done pushing numbers around, I ended up losing one Eidolon along the way, so that there were only 7 Enchantresses in the deck that I registered. But I settled on a deck that had 4 Utopia Sprawl, 4 On Thin Ice, 4 Setessan Champion, 3 Eidolon of Blossoms. Then to round out my enchantment suite, I decided to go with Dryad of the Elysian Grove as a 4 of. Now, this is a card that we know in Modern is quite powerful in conjunction with Valakut. That's an interaction that you see in Titan decks where there's all these mana sources, all these ways to like find lands, make extra land plays. If I was just going to play the Dryad, I would need either a very high land count or some way to get extra lands. So I thought that maybe my Enchantresses would draw me cards and do some of that work by finding me more lands naturally like that. But I thought I should have something else, so I put some Ren and Sixes into the deck as well. So maybe have the Ren and Six plus Dryad combination to just make a lot of land plays. Then to round it out, I had some Courser of Kruphix, a couple of Klothis, God of Destiny, some Lightning Bolts just to have a little extra interaction, and the dream of ultimating Ren and Six and getting that emblem. One of like Chain to the Rocks, Ixalan's Binding. At the last minute, I kind of chickened out and put 4 Arbor Elves into the deck. I thought, I need some actual good cards in here. And we know that Utopia Sprawl and Arbor Elf are the beginning of a solid curve that also, when you happen to draw both of the right sequence, can lead to some explosive starts. When I put all that into a deck, I ended up with a deck with 25 lands and a good number of enchantments, but not that many. I didn't have quite as many enchantments as I actually needed. So what happened was, I took the deck into the league. I went 1-4. It was a bit tricky to make the deck work. The hardest thing to do was actually trigger the constellation. My enchantment count was just like a little bit off. I think I needed 4 to 6 more enchantments in the main deck. So what I found myself doing most of the time was siding out the Arbor Elves and siding out some number of Ren and Sixes just to get more enchantments into the deck. Now, in the sideboard, I had a lot of help coming. I had effects like Rest in Peace out of the sideboard. I had Suppression Fields there for matchups where they're good. I had an extra Chain to the Rocks. I even had Ghostly Prison, another Ixalan's Binding, and I had Leyline of Sanctity. So a lot of the cards that I wanted to turn to as my sort of strong cards that will swing the matchup in my favor were enchantments, and they were going to come out of the board. I was considering even putting them main deck. So that part was okay, but just the sort of pH balance of the deck was a little bit off. It was not quite there.
Dan, you sent us this list and we gave you good feedback and you just ignored it.
Oh, I sent it to you after I'd already joined the league.
Ugh. Why?
Oh, well.
You could have said it before you tried.
What was your good feedback?
Well, we were saying you probably wouldn't need the Renin 6s very much.
Yeah, Enchantress decks tend to flood out because you just wind up drawing a lot of cards. Like the Pioneer deck with 22 lands would flood out. You have 25 lands and 3 Renin 6s, and so even with the Dryads, that seems like too many mana sources. The deck didn't have any kind of closers necessarily that like can take over a game once you are getting your Enchantress engine going.
I'm curious about your removal suite here. You have 8 removal spells. Did you feel like that was sufficient, excessive, or deficient?
I felt like when I needed removal, I didn't have enough, and when I didn't need removal, I had too much.
Mm. One of those leagues, eh?
I'll give you an example. I played against 2 Red Prowess decks. I lost the first one and I beat the second one. But in the post-Cyborg games, I think 3 different times in post-Cyborg games, I began the game with Leyland of Sanctity in play. So they couldn't target me with Lava Spikes or Lightning Bolts or anything like that. So I should have been in great shape. But against a deck like that, if you're not drawing your Rest in Peace, they will eventually just burn through all their stuff and find Bedlam Revelers and start chaining. So they're actually going up cards, whereas I'm struggling to actually go up on cards. So at some point, you know, turn 8 or 10 or whatever, they haven't made a ton of progress, but they're still full of gas and they're drawing more Killing Fiends and Soulscar Mages and that kind of thing. So without an engine going, I was sort of slowly falling behind against that style of deck. Similarly, I played against White-Black Eldrazi Taxes, and that was a close match. I thought I was going to win, but then it kind of slipped away in game 3, where a lot of the creatures that they were playing, they represented 2-for-1s, like Tide Hollow Scholars, Thought Not Seers, that kind of thing. So I kind of needed to kill them, and I didn't quite have the density of removal, even after sideboard, to get rid of them all.
So if you made the proposed changes you're talking about, where you maybe increase your density of enchantments, do you think the deck is salvageable, or just moving closer to the classic 2-3-3-2 modern list?
It's a good question. Damon, you had suggested maybe put a Scapeshift in as like the big finisher. The Dryad Valakut endgame was the best thing about the deck. That's not news. I mean, that's a powerful endgame in Modern. But without a prime time to back it up, there were times where the Dryad might just die, and then I have all the pieces except the Dryad because the Dryad's gone. I don't have enough natural mountains to like actually get there. So maybe the deck needs something else. I don't think Scapeshift is what I would use because that requires a total retooling of the mana base. Maybe just Primeval Titan. Alternately, I think what might be leaning more into the skills of the cards in my deck would be to just bite the bullet and put all the sideboard enchantments into the main deck. Like take the Rest in Pieces, put the main deck. Take the Suppression Fields, put the main deck. That would replace the Renin 6s, replace the Arbor Elves. I found that speed was less relevant for me than just having powerful effects and a density of enchantments.
Yeah, the Legacy Enchantress deck functions as this kind of prison slash combo deck, and you've built more of a mid-range deck. And so, yeah, if you kind of double down on the enchantments to make it more of the enchantment combo plus more kind of prison pieces, like Suppression Field, Ghostly Prison, that makes a lot of sense to me as being a direction to go with this.
You have a lot of fetch lands for a Suppression Field deck.
Well, that was because you'd have to cut the Renin 6. I had those in the main, and I took them out and replaced them with a Renin 6 engine instead.
Yeah, you just cut the red. You don't need fetches then.
So things like the land count being as high as it was a concession to the Dryad of the Elysian Grove. And maybe that sort of little cascading decisions like that I found were changing the composition and the balance of the deck. At core, if you want the constellation cards to be good, you have to, from the get-go, say, I'm not going to go below 26, 27 enchantments or something like that. And I was slightly below that threshold.
Yeah, I think that with Enchantress, once you kind of get the Enchantress going, you'll just always either have enchantments or lands. And so you keep casting enchantments until you miss, and you miss into a land. And so you'll just always have tons of lands. That means that you probably don't need quite so many mana sources.
So the other thing that I learned from this league is that Setessan Champion kind of sucks in Modern compared to Eidolon of Blossoms. What I mean by that is every time I drew a champion, I would really wish that it were an Eidolon of Blossoms because I was not in a position where, you know, I was going to slam the champion unprotected on the first turn I could because it was usually the only thing I had going on in my hand. So I needed to at least get a card off it. The Eidolon of Blossoms, because it triggers on itself, is kind of like a Tireless Tracker that makes a clue right away. Setessan Champion is like a Tireless Tracker that you play without a land to back it up. And unfortunately, this is less of an issue in Pioneer, I think, but in Modern, there are plenty of instant speed ways to just kill the champion in response to you casting your follow-up enchantments. So even if I waited till I had 4 mana to go like champion plus on thin ice, they would still lightning bolt the champion in response. Whereas in Pioneer, that probably wouldn't happen because it's hard to actually pick off a champion like that at instant speed.
Yeah, the trade-off is, of course, that there is no 1 mana enchantment that you want to play in Pioneer, so it giveth and it taketh away.
Right. And Modern also, it has such a disparity of play patterns you have to be prepared for. Like, I played against Jund and against Jun, like, you have to be ready to just play the lowest of low resource games. But then I also played against Giftstorm, where it's like, okay, the only thing that matters is, do I find my Rest in Peace and my hate cards in time? And did I have the right enchantments in my sideboard? It turns out that I had some of the right enchantments. I was a turn away from killing them in game 3, but then they just played an Aria of Flame and cast their hand, even though I had locked them out under Rest in Peace. Modern's a harsher place, and it was a little bit punishing for some questionable calls in the final 75 that I registered. The overall principle is still somewhat sound in the fact that, like, some of these enchantments are good in the right matchups, and you can probably fill out a deck with enough of them if you're willing to gamble and register more of the powerful sideboard enchantments as main deck cards and be willing to play, like, more of that prison game that Damon is describing.
But, I mean, you can do that without Setessan Champion. You could just play 4 Eidolon Blossoms for a card that always is a 2-for-1.
Correct, you can. That's for sure.
All right, well, I think that kind of sums up our experience experimenting with Setessan Champion. We are going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we are going to talk about our card of the week. Stay tuned.
Welcome back. Our card of the week is Narset, Parter of Veils, coming from War of the Spark. I think most of you are probably familiar with what Narset does, but just to go over that, it's 1 blue-blue for a 5 loyalty planeswalker that says, everybody's favorite static text, each opponent can't draw more than one card each turn, and then -2, it basically does the Search for his Kanta treatment, which says you get to look at the top 4 and reveal a non-creature, non-land card and put it into your hand. And so coming in at 5 loyalty, you basically have the chance to use Narset twice, leaving her with 1 loyalty to sit there with a static to bother your opponent to no end. This card has seen a lot of play across a lot of different formats. One of the kind of biggest interesting decks was this kind of Conley Woods blue deck with like Commandeer and other pitch spells, Day's Undoing, and other such things. Narset has seen play all the way down to Legacy, where she completely hoses Brainstorm, like just completely hoses Brainstorm and heavily nerfs Ponder, among other things. Like, it's kind of weird to say that, you know, if your opponent has a Jace the Mind Sculptor and you have a Narset in play, she just blanks the Jace, basically. Narset currently sees play in Pioneer in sideboards of the Inverter deck because it's just good against the opposing Jaces, so they can't use it as a card advantage engine. Narset, fundamentally, if your opponent doesn't really have combat damage, just kind of sits there and they have to devote, you know, maybe a full spell to killing her. Meanwhile, she's seen play in varying numbers in blue-white control decks in both Modern and Pioneer of varying numbers. She kind of goes in and out of favor. Right now, she's maybe a little bit more on the out-of-favor side of things, but certainly a powerful card. So, Dave, what had Narset on your mind where you wanted to kind of come back to this War of the Spark hit?
Well, one, we have not done a blue card in a while, so we like to mix it up. You know, sometimes we get a little too into our mid-range green kind of nonsense.
Emery is not really a blue card, as you guys heard when we tried to brew around it. They ended up being some weird, greeny artifact mid-range decks anyways.
Yeah, exactly. The nature of the deck restrictions, at least in Pioneer, force you to abandon its blue nature. I actually think Narset is very well positioned right now. It is really good in Pioneer against Uro. Uro is a sorcery speed draw spell that cannot get you all your sweet value with Narset. And the front half of Uro is actually pretty actively bad if you're just spending 3 mana to gain 3 life. It's also a card that does not pressure Narset easily. I also just think that some of the more like combo-ier elements of Narset haven't really been explored. I've tooled around with them in the past, and we've kind of always had, you know, better things to do, and there aren't that many cards from Theros that are that conducive to brewing, I don't think, so I wanted to take a revisit an old friend, Miss Narset.
So a question for you, Dave. When you or when other people say Narset is well positioned, are you mainly talking about the static ability having a lot of effect in the metagame, preventing opponents from drawing twice on their turn, or are you talking just about the overall play pattern of paying 3 mana for a card that can do 2 impulse effects?
That depends. I often am thinking about the static ability. You know, when that's good, it is amazing. What you're seeing with some of the ways that Pioneer is being built out specifically is when decks get comboier, then playing to the board isn't quite as important. And so, as Damon had said, Narset is quite good against Inverter, and it's also good against the Lotus Veil decks, because those decks don't pressure it. So you're going to get your full 2-for-1, and it's also going to stop a lot of what they're trying to do. So you just have this passive card that interacts with these combo decks instead of having to load up your sideboard, like the leaky bucket issue like Damon's talking about, where you have to really plan to lose game one and try to win games 2 and 3 and change your whole plan. This just gives you a passive enough way that you only have to put a few extra cards in. Also, its impulse ability, just finding key cards, is very important in Pioneer, because Pioneer is much more about its sideboard. As we've talked about, it's become a little bit more like a modern light. When you have this like faux tutor effect that starts to find the crucial cards, that's very powerful, even if you only get one effect out of it and the passive isn't doing anything.
Yeah, Narset is one of these, another kind of blue, anti-blue card. Her static typically hoses blue decks more than other decks, although she'll definitely make cards like Tireless Tracker and Modern kind of like a lot worse, among other things.
Arkham's Astrolabe as well. So I guess the flip side of my question is, when is Narset bad? Narset has been legal for almost a year now. It really had a glorious moment when War of the Spark was first released, because Arclight Phoenix decks were really common and they were cantripping all the time, and Narset was one of the most powerful things you could do against them. But actually, I went looking to see how much has this been showing up in Modern, and it's really hard to find Narset decks at all from the past few months. You know, you'll find a couple here and there in the sideboards, but people are not turning to this card in Modern, and I'm wondering, is that because there's something like, is Narset just a bad play? Why are people not turning to Narset? When is it bad?
I think if Narset's static isn't quite relevant, the dig really has to hit kind of silver bullet cards. Otherwise, she just gets hit and dies, or just doesn't really do enough. So for example, if your opponent's playing humans in Modern and you play like a Narset and she doesn't find anything but a Supreme Verdict, they kind of just kill her. You like didn't go down a card, but you went down a lot of tempo. They wasted an attack, but you wasted your whole turn casting her. Amulet Titan decks, like, they just don't care about the static at all either.
Yeah, I think to piggyback on what Damon's saying, Narset needs to be finding a card that's helping you, like, win the game. She needs to be doing something unfair in Modern, because the play pattern of pay 3 mana, impulse, gain 3 life, maybe against Burn that's okay, but against everybody else, that's pretty tough. So the Modern list I proposed is using her specifically in that way, where we're not trying to just grind out value over the course of multiple turns. We're trying to end the game without your opponent getting to take that many game actions. And I think that's kind of how you have to think about her. I don't think her passive is that powerful in Modern right now. So I think you do need to use her minus 2 ability to find a combo piece to try to win the game.
Yeah, one interesting thing I've observed with Narset is that there are secretly like a lot of cards that are pretty good that just fundamentally draw a card but don't explicitly draw a card. So for example, like Sleight of Hand versus Serum Visions, one draws a card, the other doesn't. So Sleight of Hand just ignores Narset's passive. Likewise, you know, Dig Through Time, they could just go straight into your hand, you're not drawing them, so she doesn't affect Dig Through Time at all. And there's like a number of examples like this, and I think maybe people have, if Narset ever dominates, people could switch more to these types of cards.
Niv-Mizzet Reborn.
Yeah, Niv-Mizzet Reborn does not care about Narset. And I think like the blue-white decks in Modern, just in Pioneer, like Teferi, Time Raveler, is just such a better 3-mana Planeswalker just in general. Like the average use case, at least in that deck, of Teferi, Time Raveler, just has a much higher floor. Against Burn, I wouldn't even call Narset a 3-mana, you know, draw a card, gain 3. I would call it 3-mana, draw 2 cards over time, but probably just die, because you took your 3-mana turn off.
Yeah, I think Teferi, Time Raveler is the other part of the story, and it's kind of counterintuitive. What does Teferi have to do with Narset? They don't seem to interact with each other at all. You could argue that Narset would hose an opposing Teferi, but if we're both playing blue, I play a Narset, you play Teferi, I think you're actually ahead, just because his static is so much more powerful than Narset's in the blue mirrors. And at the end of the day, in terms of deck composition, you can't have that many 3-drop Planeswalkers. So I think if Teferi did not exist, Narset would be much more popular.
It's not just for the mirror either. That is certainly true, that if you have a Narset and I have a Teferi, like, I'm just so far ahead.
But no, I mean, against the field, Teferi is also so much more powerful.
Yeah.
You really have to like have a good reason to turn to Narset. But then again, that's a very unique static, and something that Dave is right to identify that as something that can be built around. Maybe on that note, we should take a look at what you have in mind for us.
Yeah, so let's look at Pioneer. I should know, I think the white-blue decks in Pioneer are moving towards playing more Narsets. I think they are right to do that because of the reasons we stated. So it's a card you should expect to play if you're playing against blue-white. I'd expect them to be playing at least 2 main. So Damon had mentioned that there had been some exploration in Modern right when Narset was released of a Day's Undoing list. That was in Modern. There wasn't even a Pioneer at the time. And so this is what I'm proposing, is a Day's Undoing list in Pioneer. The focus of this deck is so much to try to trigger with Day's Undoing that we're also playing three Notion Thieves, which has similar text to Narset, where it punishes your opponent for drawing an extra card. And in fact, Notion Thief gives those cards to you. So a Day's Undoing is even more punishing. Other than that, it's basically just a blue-black control shell. So you're playing, you know, some counter spells. You're playing four Thoughtseize, four Fatal Push, four Opt. A crucial card to note here is four Brazen Borrower. This card is kind of a finisher. It gives you something to do if they don't play into your counter magic. And its bounce ability is really relevant because it kind of handles any random permanent. You know, sometimes blue-black isn't good at killing planeswalkers, or maybe it's not good at killing a bunch of creatures or whatever. You can bounce something into your opponent's hand if you're going to Day's Undoing with a Narset or Notion Thief in play, and you've all of a sudden kind of handled that permanent without having the specific answer. So Brazen Borrower is a really nice catch-all. It can also threaten planeswalkers. You know, if you play it out in response with Teferi, you're at least altering the course of what they can do with that card. The one thing that's interesting is how many dig through times you want to play. We know obviously that Inverter plays four and it gets a lot of value out of the exile in the graveyard. Because we're hoping a Day's Undoing, that's kind of a soft hose of our opponent's dig through times because we're attacking their graveyard. But also exiles our it removes our graveyard as well. So I don't think we want to be too all in on dig through times, but the card is so powerful, maybe the second one is correct.
Yeah, the thing with dig through time is like I think it's really good if your A plan like doesn't work, that you just like, okay, well, I spend two mana, like I sneak in a dig through time, and then all of a sudden you're like ready to go again at your A plan.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of like cards that can be moved around here. A card that I've always really liked is Dictate of Kruphix. That's basically a flash Howling Mind. It's one blue-blue artifact. And the play patterns here allow you to, you know, hold up counter magic. Maybe they play around it, or maybe they play something that's not worth countering. You Dictate of Kruphix on your end of turn. You get to draw your extra card. And then if you have Narset or Notion Thief, you prevent your opponent from drawing or even draw their extra card yourself. And Notion Thief, again, we have to point out in Pioneer, is not that easy to kill unless they're playing red at instant speed. Fatal Push is not turned on in their upkeep normally. So you have an opportunity to get like a 3-for-1 or more. That's kind of all you need when you have all this cheap interaction at 1 and 2 mana. So
yeah, I really like the kind of flash aspect this deck looks like it can take on with these Brazen Borrowers, maybe even like Dictate of Kruphix's along with counter spells and removal, even like Notion Thief. Like if you go EOT Dictate of Kruphix and your opponent like counters it, then you can untap and play Narset and probably be in a pretty good spot against control. Conversely, if you go EOT Notion Thief, once you have the Dictate in play and they counter it, you can untap and play Narset. And so I feel like the flash aspect of this will give you a pretty good anti-control angle.
I want to talk about the card Day's Undoing in particular. This is 2 and a blue sorcery. Each player shuffles their graveyard and their hands back into their library, draws a fresh 7 cards. Now, if it's your turn, you have to end the turn. This is actually a callback all the way to Alpha, to the card Time Twister, which is one of the power 9. It's kind of amazing to think about that, because as people have tried to put this card into more and more decks or played similar versions of the effect, like Diminishing Returns or whatever, they found that it's actually kind of bad. It's not really a card you should play in one-on-one competitive Magic, because spending your mana to give them a fresh hand tends to not work out for you, something we learned when we played Gear Up or Orrery.
Yeah, I've heard that Time Twister is maybe going to be given the Pluto treatment of the Power 9.
Exactly.
So you mentioned, Damon, that when Narset was first released from War of the Spark, there was some interest in a Day's Undoing deck in Modern using Narset's static ability. And that deck really leaned into this question of, if I want to make Day's Undoing slightly less bad of a card, what would I have to do? What would the rest of my deck look like? And I think the solution was to put a bunch of bounce spells in the deck, because bounce is often like pretty cheap. Like the effect doesn't cost that much mana because you're actually going down a card every time you do it. The card on summon is great. It's like Path to Exile, anything, unconditional, except that you're just down a card and they still have the card in their hand. Brazen Borrower, similarly, bounce anything for 2 mana, it's gone, but you're not actually up a card. The thing is, if you're planning to refill hands and have each player draw 7, then not only are you getting back whatever you invested in your bounce spells, so it doesn't matter that you went down cards, but also the fact that you put your opponent's permanents back into their hands and then shuffle them away means you're actually kind of doubly erasing the cost of these bounce spells. And in Modern, you can take that even further with pitch spells, cards that you can cast for free if you exile additional cards in your hand, because card economy means something slightly different when you're planning to do this draw 7 effect. So were there elements of that kind of thing that you think are worth doing in a Pioneer version of a Day's Undoing deck?
Yeah, so I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, we're playing 4 cheap removal spells in Fatal Push. I mentioned the 4 Brazen Borrower. You just talked about bounce. The other reason is because depending on game state, you're going to get a bunch of free wins by casting Day's Undoing against someone who's inverted with less than 7 cards in their library and hand. Just today, I played against Inverter. I played 5 games against them. So on turn 5 or 6, Day's Undoing would have been lethal in every circumstance, even the one where I stole their Jace.
That's amazing.
It gives you a strange amount of game against this very weird way that the best deck, or maybe not the best deck, 49% win percentage, ignore all the pros telling you it's great. It gives you a main deck way that you can just steal wins out of nowhere. You can be way behind. Obviously, if Jace is in play, it doesn't do that. So you have to be conscious of that. But that's where Brazen Borrower comes in. But yeah, you have a 1-card win against them in a bunch of different circumstances. So that's another reason that it's attractive.
Yeah. There's no good pitch spells in Pioneer, are there?
I think they did a pretty good job not making free spells exist, and getting rid of Once Upon a Time was a big part of that.
Yeah. One concern is that the Narset Day's Undoing, like, you're spending a fair amount of mana to not affect the board at all. You can try to squeeze in like a couple petty thefts, but the mana just gets tight on that.
You can't get zero mana effects, but you can get great discounts if you're willing to lose card economy. Lightning Axe would be a card that does that. 1 mana, kill almost anything if you discard a second card. There's also a card called Void Snare. It's a sorcery for a single blue that just bounces a permanent. That's a pretty discounted rate for that effect, but it's just a bad card because you're down a card. You could sort of play a lot of stuff like that.
Any non-land permanent.
Oh, yes, sorry. That would be amazing if it bounced lands. That would be so good.
You knew that, obviously. I'm just making it clear to our listeners. You do not wish that was legal. Nobody would be having any fun.
So you could lean into things like that. I mean, arguably, a Void Snare is more valuable than a Thoughtseize in the sense that, you know, if you Thoughtseize them and then you cast Day's Undoing, you just gave them the cards back. Whereas if you Void Snare the thing they spent mana on, you gain some tempo and then they didn't get the card back.
I suspect this deck really is trying to set up Day's Undoing with one of its combo pieces in the Narset or the Notion Thief.
Yeah.
Naked Day's Undoing is really just not where you want to be going with this.
Fair enough.
You have 7 cards that interact with Day's Undoing positively, so you don't have to cast it.
What I wonder is if, like, the main deck needs more sweeper-type effects, whether that be straight-up Languish or Engulf the Shore. I'm not sure if the island count for that. I think that's one of the reasons why the deck was mainly just straight blue in the modern iteration of this. Engulf the Shore, normally, you know, they can just recast all those spells. Well, with the Day's Undoing combo, they can't because they just disappear.
Yeah, that's definitely possible.
I even wonder about, like, for example, Thing in the Ice.
Thing in the Ice feels like a great sideboard option. The main deck is not too heavy on creatures. There's just 2 Jace, Fringe Prodigy, 4 Brazen Borrower.
3 Notion Thief.
Never mind.
But yeah, as a sideboard option, I think that kind of juke out of these spell-based decks is always really interesting, and it is a good blocker, you know, against decks that are going to try to race you on the ground. Do you have the heart to block a 1/2 prowess creature? You know, that's up to each individual man or woman.
I'm starting to think that I would want Thing in the Ice in the sense that you have enough creatures main deck that, like, you're pretty sad if your Notion Thief gets killed. If Thing in the Ice serves as like a lightning rod for that removal, like, that's actually okay, I guess. It saves your more important combo piece creature. And if it doesn't, Thing in the Ice can really run away with a game in some context.
But take a good look at this and tell me when you're going to flip a Thing in the Ice. You can't do it with this build. It's going to take forever to flip.
No, I mean, Narset finds you spells, right? Brazen Borrower's a spell.
Your fastest flip would be Thing on turn 2, block something. Narset turn 3. It's turn 4. You haven't removed any counters from Thing in the Ice yet. This is just very hard. This is not a cantrip-heavy format. You have 4 ups, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have Snapcaster, I guess. But I mean, I played Blue Moon. In Arclight Phoenix, it was funny where sometimes I would like flip a Thing in the Ice and it still has Summoning Sickness. But conversely, I would also play Thing in the Ice in Blue Moon, and that deck doesn't always flip it that quickly. Sometimes that's just not actually really all that bad.
You can report back on your findings with it.
Fair. One card I think is essential in this deck is Gaia Reach Sanitarium. I don't see it in this list. That's what lets you really turn the corner post Day's Undoing Narset.
Gaia Reach Sanitarium is a legendary land. It taps for a colorless, but it also has the activated ability, pay 2 and tap it. Each player draws a card and then discards a card. That text, each player draws, effects like that are really valuable with the static on Narset and with Notion Thief's ability. In theory, they're costed on the assumption that everyone's benefiting, but in reality, only you will benefit. So the particular combo with Gaia Reach Sanitarium allows you to activate it on their upkeep before they've drawn for the turn. They've already drawn and discarded once, and now they can't draw anymore. So even when they go their draw step, they don't get their regular draw step.
Right. So they don't even like really get priority to cast instants if there are 0 cards in hand. They just draw and immediately discard as part of the ability resolving. And so they're just kind of completely locked out of drawing a card ever.
It's worth noting that the Notion Thief lock is not quite as hard. You have to do it during their draw step, so they'll still be able to cast instants. but you'll get to draw an extra card for them.
Oh, hold on a second. How does this work with Notion Thief? Notion Thief is weird.
During their draw step, they draw their normal card. And before they leave their draw step, you activate Gaia Reach. So you both draw and discard. You have to complete your entire draw and discard before you see what you draw for them. You loot as normal. Then you replace their draw with you drawing, and then they have to discard a card. So if they didn't draw an instant, they have to discard it immediately, and you draw an extra card. So you loot and then draw a card with Notion Thief in play.
And so if you want to lock them down, you can only lock down their non-instants, and you do it after they draw in their draw step.
Exactly. So Narset is the actual hard lock where you should do it during their upkeep. Notion Thief is a card you should be waiting till their draw step and hoping they don't draw an instant.
When there are zero cards in hand. I guess if they don't have zero cards in hand, actually, you do want to upkeep it.
Yeah, exactly. Well said.
Okay.
So yeah, they react a little differently, and they also respond to Day's Undoing a little differently. Because Notion Thief is not a trigger, it does get all the cards from Day's Undoing. The end of turn isn't terminating. You're just getting to draw 14 cards. And their hand is empty.
Drawing 14. Sounds nice.
You're going to have to find a way to win from there. That's up to you.
How are you going to flip a thing in the ice with 14 cards in hand? Doesn't sound possible.
It's hard to imagine.
Any love for the card Commit to Memory?
I thought about it as a one-off. The card has always just seemed so sweet to me, and it's always so clunky. So maybe as a possible sideboard card in like control mirrors, but I don't think I want it main. If I'm going to put a 4-mana card in there, I think it's going to be a Languish-like effect, like Damon's discussing. Yeah, I mean, 4 mana is just tough, especially as the one blue counter, a blue spell, is everywhere. Either half of that is just so susceptible to that. I mean, just paying 4 mana and getting blown out for 1 mana just hashtag feels bad.
How about the card Gira Per Orrery? It's actually really good with the cards you have in the deck.
No, it isn't. It's still bad. It's always...
Emptying their hand, so are they required to draw 3? I think they can actually choose not to. I think it's a May. You don't even get to juke them with your terrible 4-mana artifact.
No, it's not a May, actually.
Oh, okay. I mean, we're never going to have 0 cards in our hand is the hope, right? So.
Well, perhaps not. I mean, maybe not with this build.
Actually, I would go so far as with Gira Per Orrery to say not with any build.
Not with any build. Do not put Gira Per Orrery in your deck, but do put Narset in your deck.
I don't know if you were around for this week, Dan, but we had a Gira Per Orrery week, and the card is just not that good.
It could be that the shell was not. Maybe the problem was us.
Yeah, maybe the players weren't good.
I'm just saying.
Narset finds Gira Per Orrery. That is a factual statement. And it's right on curve. Tap out on turn 3, don't affect the board. Tap out on turn 4, don't affect the board. It's hard to imagine losing from that position. So, I mean, it's worth trying out.
For the listeners, I want to be very clear here that we just had a very long discussion about a deck built around Day's Undoing, which is an unplayable, terrible mythic. With a straight face, you know, we're talking about this as if this is going to work. But when I suggest Gira Per Orrery, which also works with the exact same effects with Narset and Notion Thief, I get laughed out of the room. It makes sense in principle.
Your card is super conditional. They have to have 0 cards in their hand. It doesn't work every draw step for them.
Gira Per Orrery is like especially... Day's Undoing is not exactly a Magic All-Star multi-format staple. But Gira Per Orrery is just like actually like a bad Magic card.
All right, we've talked about Gira Per Orrery, so it's time to abandon Pioneer. I also have a list here for Modern, and it takes advantage of the fact that Narset helps you find a bunch of spells in the Turns list. So Turns is a archetype in Modern that has seen a bunch of different variants over the years, and I think the recent most powerful ones have involved Fires of Invention and Savor the Moment. When Fires of Invention was spoiled, we mentioned that Savor the Moment's drawback doesn't really punish you as much, and the fact that it's a extra turn you can take the turn you play Fires on 4 lands is very powerful. So Narset again is a 3 drop that kind of curves right into your 4 drop. So Narset can find Fires of Invention, and so in the way that Damon was describing, they might just ignore Narset and start dinging you up, but Narset finding Fires of Invention means that they might not get a turn after that. And that's the kind of like unfair play pattern I think you need to use when you're playing Narset in Modern, because taking a turn off to not affect the board can be rough. Another card I'm interested in trying out is Uro, Titan of Nature's Wrath. Extra land drops are very relevant in Fires decks. Uro also gives you life. We're playing the sort of 4 Astrolabe, 3 Ren, and 6 combo anyway, so you can kind of get your way up to 2 green eventually if you need to like win the game. And then Narset rewards you because if you play it under Fires, the look for your top 4 twice as you take a bunch of turns is really important. You find Time Warp, you find Savor the Moment. All of these lists are benefiting greatly because you can go find a Mystic Sanctuary with all your fetch lands. And Mystic Sanctuary puts Time Warp or Savor the Moment back on top of your deck. Then you take another turn.
There is a deterministic lock here with Uro and Cryptic Command and Mystic Sanctuary. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Does that let you cast Time Warp every turn? Or am I reading that wrong?
If you have five lands. It also exists with the Dictate. Dictate and Uro both draw a card every turn.
Sorry, what is this lock with Cryptic Command and Time Warp and Uro? Like, I get how you can maybe lock down their creatures, but I don't see how you can also loop Time Warp.
So you cast Time Warp. You have to then play Mystic Sanctuary, put it on top, attack and draw. So that you have to just keep bouncing your Mystic Sanctuary, basically.
Yeah.
So you need the Cryptic for that.
But then you need to recycle a Cryptic.
Yeah, so you can't do it. So there isn't one.
You need some sort of like land bounce, like a what's that, four and a blue Maloku type card.
Yeah, Maloku the Clouded Mirror.
Yeah, this seems a little bit too far out.
Yeah, we don't need to do any of that nonsense.
What you can do is Ultimate Red and Six pretty quickly with a sequence like that. It's not out of the question.
I think in practice, you kind of go effectively infinite. If you're drawing multiple cards a turn, or you have like a Planeswalker drawing you extra cards, you just find Time Warps at a rate of more than one per turn.
Yeah, there's no need to go deterministic. And the reason that Chandra here is specifically because she ultimates very quickly, and then you only have to cast like three spells in Modern to win the game. Alternatively, you can Renin 6 ultimate and cast like five Lightning Bolts, which you can do over the course of five turns with five lands. So anyway, you have a bunch of other like kind of interesting angles of attack. There's two lonely sandbars here, so you can kind of turn, once you don't need mana anymore with Fires of Invention, you can kind of turn your Renin 6 into this like card advantage engine to like keep grinding to try to find more Time Warps while you're moving your Planeswalker towards ultimate. V-Click is sort of an anti-combo card. It has synergy with Narset because it actually, after it discards your opponent's card, asks them to draw a card. So it can be used as a card advantage engine against your opponent. It is a way to target yourself, to like loop through extra versions of like Renin 6 that you don't want. You get to draw an extra card. Yeah, so Narset just finds your like win conditions. It finds your Fires of Invention on curve, and it finds your extra turn spells when those are needed.
It's important to remember that the card Fires of Invention allows you to play two spells without paying mana for them, but you still have your lands on tap. So if you have something that you can spend your mana on, you can do like a third thing in a turn. So I think that Lonely Sandbar line is actually pretty clever. The other thing you can do is you can cast Uro, Titan, and Nature's Wrath with Escape. That does count against your two spell quota, but you have to pay the mana for the Escape, and Fires does not prevent you from doing that. You're still eligible to pay mana for spells. You just have the option to not pay mana if it's from your hand. Those are things you can do with the mana here. I see you also have Mikokoro, Center of the Sea, as one of your lands that has an activated ability. Would you consider the Sanitarium for this? The Gaia Reach Sanitarium?
I think you need to pick one or the other. You need to play enough islands that your Mystic Sanctuaries are turned on early. And I think this is just better. If you're taking all the turns, you'd rather just get the straight up card advantage as opposed to the loot. But I'm open to the other one being better. I have not played one or the other. But when I've seen Daniel Wong build these decks and he picks one, he picks Mikokoro. For people who don't know, he is kind of the turns guru. He's made a bunch of different variants of this shell in different metagames with different color pairings, etc. I was just deferring to his judgment because I'm sure he's gotten an insane amount of reps with these lists.
According to Goldfish, he has, as recently as February 29th, 2020, got third place in the Magic Fest Reno Saturday PTQ. So that's a pretty good result.
Yeah, there you go. We remember in the height of the Modern Horizons, they need to ban. He got in the draw bracket and then top eighted. And we were like, oh, man, is this turns deck the way to, beat all these graveyard decks? And then he was just like, no, I got in the draw bracket. And of course, never played any of these graveyards decks and just cruised to the top eight. I just love how humble he was about it. Like, I never had a chance against
yeah,
the wave of Vengevines and anything. I just drew my first game and then just dominated.
Yeah, there's probably a way to like build a draw bracket crushing deck and just like unethically find some way to draw your first round. It seems like the draw bracket tends to be a mix of like blue white and for some reason Eldrazi Tron.
The real Drago.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I like the look of this list. I'm excited to try it out.
I put four Astrolabes in there so you guys couldn't resist it.
I kind of want another Narset just to see what Narset can do. I guess two is fair.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Narset is that Jace is, once you kind of set up your loops, way better. He just is like a really consistent way to just start tearing through your deck, especially with all the fetch lands. So Narset is just lowering the curve a little bit. You want some of those effects and you want to find your fires as soon as possible. And she's very good at doing that. And then kind of once you're going off, I think you do need the four mana planeswalkers to win the game.
One of the things that gives you an off-ramp, when you're trying to string extra turns together, if you don't succeed in actually taking all the turns until you win, you can at least build up a lot of loyalty on Planeswalkers or get a bunch of Planeswalker activations in. And Narset kind of awkwardly doesn't do that. Narset, you can activate once or twice, and that's it. After that, she's out of loyalty.
So having planeswalkers like Chandra Torch of Defiance, like Jace the Mind Sculptor, like Ren and Six, these are the ones that could actually just win the game, even if you fizzle out your turn sequence.
Also, they will help you take infinite turns, whereas Narset helps you take a few turns.
But the series of infinite turns must start with a few turns, and I think that's where Narset is important.
I think with these decks, you typically don't have a lot of time to set up your engine, in the sense that like so many of your cards are devoted towards taking a lot of turns, that like around turn 4 or 5, you really kind of got to go infinite effectively immediately. My slight concern is that like you kind of can't actually just fizzle. Like if you fizzle, you're going to lose the game. That might not be true. I've never played this deck before. I have a lot to learn about it.
I think that is true. I think you need to be considering, if I'm going for it now, is there a reasonable chance I can, you know, win the game basically, or get to a point where they have to actually attack my planeswalkers or something.
When I'm looking at the main deck, apart from the 4 Fires of Invention, the 4 Time Warp, and the 4 Savor the Moments, the rest of these are cards I'd just be happy to have in any mid-range control deck. It's like team or planeswalkers. There's always that. If you don't think you're going to get there with a turn strategy, your sideboard could all be interaction, and you just sort of forget the Savor the Moment stuff, forget the fire stuff, and just bring in all your interaction. The team or mid-range planeswalker plan is actually on par, power level-wise, I think, with what a lot of modern decks try to do. If it's just a question of slowing them down a little bit, you can win with that way, the fair play.
And it's important to note, when you're going off with your turns, cast all your turn spells first when you have all your mana on tap before you start using Mikukoro, etc., because you can pay for Mystical Dispute because you're not spending any mana with your fires in play. I've been burned by that in various other fire shells before. Order really matters, and Mystical Dispute is a card you should be considering playing around all the time. The one card that's actually really good against this is the Blue Force of Negation. It actually exiles a spell if it resolves. So it's not just that it counters your extra turn, it removes that spell from your graveyard, so it's no longer a target for Mystic Sanctuary. I'm not sure if there's a way around that or not. You might want to play your own Mystical Disputes, but that's just such an awkward card when you're trying to play fires. So
yeah, I can't tell if this deck kind of naturally has a positive control matchup or not. This is something I'm curious to learn. It feels like it has to if Daniel Wong cruised through the ID bracket so all the way to a top 8. I'm sure he played against Blue-White a handful of times there.
Well, he was not playing Fires of Invention. This is a more recent...
Sure.
I think LSV had 5-0 with a build like this after Eldraine was released.
Yeah.
This is a more spicy build of turns. But if I were going to sideboard for a matchup like that, I might start by taking out some of the fires and just bringing in more counter spells. Like you could bring in Teferi, Time Raveler. I mean, you have Astrolabe, so your mana should be fine.
Famous last words.
Exactly.
I mean, I think having 4 Ren and Sixes on its own, like, it gives you a lot of equity and control matchups.
So yeah, those are just 2 ideas that I have for Narset. If anyone else has any sweet Narset brews out there, don't hesitate to send them in or discuss them on the Discord. We will try out these or maybe some other Narset decks this week, and we will report back next week on our findings. Until then, I hope everyone stays healthy, stay safe.
Yeah, wash your hands, play some MTGO.
Yeah, we'll see you beyond the veil.
See you.
All right, take care.
That'll do it for this edition of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. You can find the deck lists from today's show at faithlessbrewing.podbean.com or in the episode description in your podcast player. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please be so kind as to leave us a rating and review. Faithless Brewing is a listener-supported show. We rely on brewers like you to help us improve the show and bring you better content. So if you like what you heard and would like to lend us your support, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. All patrons get access to our Discord channel and other cool rewards, but more important than that, the contributions of our supporters are what allow this show to get made. So thank you again to all of our patrons and all of our listeners. We look forward to hearing from you, and we will see you next week. The cat just walked on my thing.
Goodbye, deck list.
Your deck list was deleted.
The cat just deleted the... Can you just control Z in the show notes?
Oh, good. Okay.
There we go.
The fourth judge has weighed in on what needs to happen with this build.
Delete.